Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is romance. Our subject today is love. Our subject today is marriage. But not between men and women, but between men and men, or perhaps women and women. We're talking about the ongoing debate on same-sex marriage. In a little while, we will talk to two people who are very involved in this issue. We'll talk to Professor Mark Strasser from the Capital University Law School, who's written extensively on the subject. We'll also speak to Jim Campbell, one of the lawyers and the pivotal, the extremely important Perry versus Schwarzenegger case out in California. But first, we will speak to my former student, Joni Burrows, who's going to give us an overview. Where are we in this debate on same-sex marriage in this country?
Well, as of June 2011, there are currently five states plus the District of Columbia that recognize gay marriage and issue marriage license to same-sex couples. Those states right now, as I mentioned, D.C. was one of them, but obviously D.C. is not a state, but Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Iowa all recognize and provide marriage certificates for same-sex couples.
And were those because of court decisions? I believe they all were, weren't they?
I believe so.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's actually amended its constitution. I do know that as we speak today, the state of New York is debating a statute that would actually authorize same-sex marriage in the state of New York. But I believe most, at least, of those other states you just mentioned have decided that same-sex marriage is a part of their own state constitutional law.
And at the same time, there are also 31 other states who have taken constitutional measures to actually ban same-sex marriage or other same-sex unions.
31 states have taken some sort of preemptive measure to make sure that that doesn't happen in their state.
Right.
And I guess I won't ask you to read the entire list there, but I guess it's a fairly extensive one.
Yeah, some of the highlights, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, South Carolina, a lot of your southern states, and surprisingly a lot of your Midwestern states, too, have really taken an active role in banning same-sex marriage.
I see. Okay. Anything else happening out there these days?
Based on a Pew Research Center survey, as of, I believe, about June 2011, about 41% of Americans either strongly favor or favor same-sex marriage, and 47% strongly oppose or oppose it, while 10% of Americans are still undecided on the subject.
So still a fairly close issue, obviously a very divisive issue. To some extent, it's one of those old red state, blue state issues that's out there. And it's being resolved with constitutional amendments. It's being resolved with statutes. And it's being resolved with court battles. And what's the biggest of those court battles out there right now?
The biggest current battle is Perry versus Schwarzenegger, which is happening out in California right now.
That's right. And we'll talk a little bit more about Perry versus Schwarzenegger later. But right now, let's go and talk to Jim Campbell, who serves as the litigation staff counsel with the Alliance Defense Fund. And Jim, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Stuart. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. Now tell us a little bit, please, about the Alliance Defense Fund and what your stance is on same-sex marriage.
Well, the Alliance Defense Fund is an organization. We operate nationwide. However, our base is in Scottsdale, Arizona. And we litigate cases dealing with religious liberty, sanctity of life, and family and marriage. So regarding the issue of marriage, we support marriage. We're an organization that firmly defends marriage in all attacks that it faces, whether it's an attack to redefine it or an attack to weaken it. It is something that we as an organization focus on supporting and strengthening marriage.
Okay. Now, other than litigation regarding same-sex marriage, what other sort of attacks on marriage are you referring to?
Well, we're involved in attacks on marriage seeking to legalize polygamous marriages.
That's, oh, okay.
That would be one example of ways in which we would be involved in other cases, as well as differing legislative matters that are trying to strengthen the institution of marriage and to reaffirm it as a basic building block of our society.
Okay. Well, now, with regard to perhaps at the moment the most famous case regarding marriage and same-sex marriage is the Perry versus Schwarzenegger case out in California, and I understand that you've been directly involved with that case.
Yes, that is correct. There is a legal team that represents the official proponents of that law, and that's the official supporters and sponsors of that law.
Mm-hmm.
The legal team consists of the Alliance Defense Fund, as well as our lead counsel, Cooper & Kirk, a law firm in Washington, D.C., and we together have been defending the people of California in their decision to enact Proposition 8 and to restore and define marriage as the union of one man and one woman.
Yeah, and that's an important point because procedurally speaking, Proposition 8 was, correct me if I'm wrong at any point, but it was an amendment to the California Constitution that was adopted pursuant to a referendum of the people of the state of California. Is that right?
It was enacted pursuant to an initiative of the state of California, which is similar but slightly different from a referendum. However, yes, everything else is correct.
Okay, and so that now becomes part of the Constitution of the state of California, but then people challenge that. And if I recall correctly, Governor Schwarzenegger, who's the named defendant in this case, at some point refused to defend the law. Is that correct?
The governor and the attorney general have refused to defend the law.
So that makes you all very important in terms of stepping into the shoes, essentially, of what the government of California would typically have done.
That is correct. The official Proposition 8 proponents and their legal counsel, the Alliance Defense Fund and Cooper and Kirk, we have stepped into that role, and we are the sole defenders of the people of California and the Proposition 8 measure.
That's a very interesting procedural position to be in. Okay, well, now that we've got that straight, please tell us how you got involved and your take on this trial. What happened at this trial?
Well, the trial is really unprecedented. There have been about a decade and a half of cases worth addressing this issue of same-sex marriage, and this is the first to go to a full-blown comprehensive trial like this.
Mm-hmm.
And at the conclusion of the trial, the court eventually ruled against the people of California and struck down Proposition 8, and now we're pursuing relief on appeal, and we're hopeful and confident that ultimately the will of the people in defining marriage as one man and one woman will prevail.
What is or what are the basic central fundamental constitutional issues in this case?
Well, the plaintiffs have raised two questions. First, they claim that there is a fundamental right to same-sex marriage under the United States Constitution. And the second claim is that the Proposition 8 measure by defining marriage as one man and one woman violates the equal protection provision of the 14th Amendment.
Okay, let me jump in with just a little bit of explanation out too, and I'll take them in reverse order. We have something called the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It's in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, and it says that that no state shall treat basically any person, no state shall discriminate against any person and deny that person equal protection of the law. And so the theory there is that by not allowing gay people to marry, there is discrimination that discriminates against gay people. The other theory there is something called the fundamental rights theory, and that is a more arcane constitutional area that comes out of something we call substantive due process analysis, and that goes more to the question of should every citizen have the right to marry, and it's not so much an equality analysis, but simply, you know, should the government be interfering with this relationship or not? Is that a fair statement of the basic lay of the land?
That's a pretty fair assessment.
Great, glad to hear it. Now, just trying to orient things. Now, why don't you take them in whatever order you please and tell us how you feel about both the fundamental rights argument and the equal protection argument?
Sure. The fundamental rights argument, we believe, is fundamentally flawed. The Supreme Court
there's a pithy statement. Okay.
The Supreme Court has been very clear that when looking to see whether a fundamental right is at issue, it's very important that that right be carefully described and particularly defined. So here, when we look at the right at issue is whether there is a right to same-sex marriage, not generically whether there is a right to marry anyone, whether there is a right to marry the person of your choice. So when we look specifically at that question, whether there is a right to same-sex marriage under the Constitution, the Supreme Court has also been very clear what we do next in the analysis, and that is to see whether that right has existed in the history and traditions of our nation. So it's very clear when you look at the history and tradition of our nation, which no state anywhere in our union recognized same-sex marriage until 2003, and at this point only a handful of them do. It's clear that the history and traditions of our nation do not support the fundamental right to same-sex marriage, and thus it is wrong to define it as a fundamental right.
Okay, and you've hit that nail on the head, because it's depends on how you define the right is going to pretty much determine whether you can find any precedent or not in favor of same-sex marriage here, because of course the seminal case, I'm guessing, on both of these issues is Loving versus Virginia, and is that pretty much what the parties argued, Loving versus Virginia?
That is certainly a primary case involved here.
Yep. Right, and that was, of course, the famous case from 1967 where the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional the anti-miscegenation laws of the state of Virginia, which had prevented Mr. and Mrs. Loving from being married because he was white and she was black. But, of course, the question is whether you define the fundamental right at issue as being the right to marry anyone you please, or whether it's more narrowly, you know, does Loving Virginia vindicate the right to same-sex marriage? And your position is, of course, that Loving versus Virginia didn't deal with same-sex marriage. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Right. But your opponents argue that it stands for the more general proposition that one should be able to marry anyone one pleases.
That is correct. And the one thing that I would add, which oftentimes gets overlooked, is that just 3 or 4 years, somewhere between 3 and 5 years after Loving versus Virginia was decided, the Supreme Court was asked to address the question of whether same-sex marriage was a fundamental right and whether it was guaranteed under the 14th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And they refused that case and found that there wasn't even a substantial question in that case. So that's very, very, very strong, compelling evidence and, frankly, binding precedent from the highest court in this land, indicating that Loving versus Virginia in particular, but the Constitution more broadly, does not contain a right to same-sex marriage.
Very interesting. Okay, well, that's the substantive due process fundamental rights analysis, and it comes down to how you define that right. Okay, and with regard to the equal protection analysis, where do you stand?
The 14th Amendment says that the government cannot treat people differently for irrational reasons. And in this case, we have argued, and we believe that our papers make it very clear, that the government has a legitimate and in some ways compelling reasons for continuing to define marriage as a unit of a man and a woman and continuing to strengthen and protect that institution.
Okay. So your response is that, both you and I have paraphrased the 14th Amendment, so let's go ahead and I'll just actually read from my pocket Constitution here. It says,
there you go.
It's always a good thing, isn't it? Eventually
it is.
We should actually read the text. No, no state shall, and then there's a few words in between, no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And as you've pointed out, the default position for most sources of discrimination is what we call the rational basis test, and that is that Congress can actually, or states can actually, treat different people differently as long as they have a legitimate reason for doing so, and that you know, reason is rationally related to the discrimination. But then, of course, there are certain categories of discrimination, such as racial discrimination or gender discrimination, which are going to get a closer look from the courts, and the justification for those sorts of discrimination has to be correspondingly stronger. Your position is that gay people don't get any higher level of scrutiny than other people, and therefore, as long as you pass that rational basis test, you're okay. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, and I will add that approximately 10 or 11 of the 12 or 13, so the point is nearly all federal appellate courts have addressed this question of whether sexual orientation is a suspect classification that would be entitled to this additional constitutional review, and every single one of those courts that has addressed this question has made it clear that sexual orientation is not a suspect classification and that it's not entitled to additional scrutiny, and instead that rational basis review applies. So we feel that we're on firm, undisputed legal grounds in making that argument.
Okay. Well, of course, you know that there are some cases out there, and I'm thinking of Romer versus Evans from 1996, where the Supreme Court overturned the Colorado constitutional provision regarding gay rights. And also, of course, the Texas case, Lawrence versus Texas, where the Supreme Court overturned the Texas sodomy statute, where even though the court didn't apply a higher level of scrutiny, even though it did not declare sexual orientation as being a suspect classification, it did nonetheless invalidate those statutes under the rational basis test. So how do you respond to that? I mean, how do those figure into your analysis?
Sure. Well, we argue here that the government has a rational, compelling purpose in support of marriage, and that is to channel naturally procreative relationships into committed unions so that the children that are eventually born of those unions will be raised in a stable, committed environment. And that is the historical purpose of marriage from the government's perspective, and that's a critical point, is we're looking at the government's interest in marriage, and that has always been, and we've cited pages and pages of evidence indicating that that's the case in the Perry case. So we argue that is the purpose of marriage, and the burden on our opponents here in seeking to redefine marriage, they must show that allowing them to access marriage, in other words, allowing same-sex couples to marry, furthers those same purposes in the same degree and in the same way. And our response to that is that they can't make that showing because it's same-sex couples do not naturally procreate like opposite-sex couples do, and therefore the government's interest is simply not the same.
Okay, well, I have to play devil's advocate and point out that, of course, not every couple that gets married is going to be able to have children. So if we allow old people to marry, or if we allow infertile couples to marry, does that tend to undercut your argument, or is there some other legitimate purpose out there that is served by restricting marriage to one man and one woman?
Again, we're talking in purposes of generalities here. When we look at marriage as a whole, it is generally understood to be a union that produces children. And, you know, even when we're talking about the infertile couple, as you raised, or the older couple who presumably can have kids, that's not necessarily the case, particularly with the infertile couple. In other words, there are scientific difficulties with proving that someone is actually infertile in many cases. So we're talking about drawing a distinction that science, let alone the law, can't really draw. The general consensus is that most people that get married often have kids, and that has been the historical purpose of marriage, and it continues to be the primary purpose of marriage. So that would be one of our many responses to that.
Okay. Well, now you've mentioned history and tradition many times, and I understand that that's certainly a line of reasoning that's often mentioned in the Supreme Court, especially some of the more conservative justices, Justice Scalia, for example, Justice Thomas. But, of course, the counter to that argument is that, you know, there are lots of things that are certainly prevalent in our history, that in our tradition, that are not so good, and that over time we have had to abandon, that the Supreme Court itself has abandoned, such as slavery. Well, and slavery was a war to abandon it, but we amended the Constitution. But things like segregation, the court has overruled, even though that was very firmly ensconced in our tradition and history. How do you respond to that? I mean, is tradition and history, is it really all that important?
Well, here we're talking about a fundamental public policy question. In other words, how we're going to define this very important institution in our society that's marriage. And when you're dealing with an important public policy question like that, the Supreme Court has indicated that that is something that is for the people to decide. And that's exactly what the people have done across the country in 90% of the states. In other words, they've been allowed to decide for themselves through either a directly enacted law or something that's enacted through the people's legislature. They've been able to decide how they want to define and understand the institution of marriage. And because this is in that critical public policy realm, and because the Supreme Court has indicated that when we're dealing with those questions, the default position is to defer to the people, we believe that there is no right under the Constitution to same-sex marriage.
All right. Well, I have to, again, ask the harder question is, then, does that mean that if, for example, the people of Massachusetts want to legalize gay marriage, that that's their right as well, constitutionally?
As far as the Constitution goes,
mm-hmm.
I don't believe that the Constitution poses a bar for example, the people of Vermont have legislatively redefined marriage to include same-sex couples, and I don't believe that the Constitution imposes a bar on that.
Well, then it creates a secondary problem, which, and I think you know where I'm going to head with this. Then what about the full faith and credit clause of Article 4? If Vermont legalizes gay marriage, then is the state of California then bound to recognize that act of the Vermont legislature?
It's actually not, and it's pretty clear under a solid constitutional analysis that it isn't. And let me explain that quickly.
Sure.
When we're dealing with interstate recognition of marriages, we're not dealing with the core of the full faith and credit clause. The full faith and credit clause, at its strength, the Supreme Court has made clear, applies to judgments and things like judgments in other states. When we're dealing with a marriage, another state's obligation to recognize that is simply a matter of what's called comity, which is a state's voluntary decision to recognize the marriages that originate in other states. Now, the default position is that states generally do recognize marriages from other states. However, there are instances where states have said that sort of union conflicts with our public policy, and therefore we will not recognize it, even though it's been entered into another state. So I think the key point is that the full faith and credit clause simply does not apply at its strength when we're talking about marriages. And instead, the principle that's at issue is the common law principle known as comity.
And that's C-O-M-I-T-Y.
That's right.
Right, not comity. Right. This is a different concept. Okay.
That's right. And when we're talking about comity, the question is whether the home state, the state that's being asked to, home is probably the wrong word, when we're talking about comity, the question is whether the state that's being asked to recognize the union wants to voluntarily do so, or whether because of its public policy it decides not to.
Okay. Well, now finally I have to get down to it. You've talked a lot about public policy and that this is a lot of public policy and that states should have the rights to determine their public policy. So let's talk about policy for a moment. If a state allows gay marriage, how does this harm anyone? What's the public policy argument against gay marriage?
There is abundant evidence from scholars in many different fields that talk about concerns regarding the redefinition of marriage. In other words, there's one way to argue, and there are many different ways to discuss it, but there's a trend in sociology that talks about the term deinstitutionalization. And what it is it's a weakening of an institution and its rules and its framework and its public understanding. There is scholarly literature out there, and there's some anecdotal evidence to support it that indicates redefining marriage will weaken the institution and will thereby have many negative impacts on the institution of marriage, such as a decrease in the marriage rate, an increase in the divorce rate, an increase in out-of-wedlock births, and a few others as well.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. We've been talking about same-sex marriage with Jim Campbell, who serves as litigation staff counsel with the Alliance Defense Fund and who worked on the famous Perry versus Schwarzenegger case out in California. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk with Mark Strasser of Capital University Law School, who also has some very strong opinions on same-sex marriage. Stay tuned.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This, I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry.
And it's time once again for our constitutional quiz with our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, are you there?
I am here, Stuart. Thank you.
Tremendous. Now, Kelly's joining us today via Skype, and so we may have a little bit of technical issues with it from time to time, but we'll just deal with that. And we also have a contestant on the line. Stanley, are you there?
I'm here.
Tremendous. Stanley, where are you from?
I'm from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho.
Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Well, welcome to the United States.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. Idaho has been a state for quite a while now, hasn't it?
Well, we're up north, but not quite as north as Canada, so I understand what you meant.
Tremendous. Well, we're happy to have you with us today. Kelly, do you have a really tough question for Stanley?
I have a good question. It's a short question, but it's an important one.
All right, then let's go with it.
All right, Stanley, we talk about the Constitution an awful lot on this show, but the question today is simple. What is a constitution? And the answer choices are A, an oral agreement among citizens, B, a statement of rights and privileges, C, a legal framework of governing, or D, a detailed code of laws and policies.
Oh, man, talk about your deceptively simple questions. Those are some tough choices. Could you go over them again, please, Kelly?
Sure. Again, what the question is, what is a constitution? Is it A, an oral agreement among citizens, B, a statement of rights and privileges, C, a legal framework of governing, or D, a detailed code of laws and policies?
Stanley, give us your reasoning.
Well, I'm pretty sure the Constitution was written, so A would not be correct, as it emphasized the fact that it was oral.
Okay.
B sounds more like the Bill of Rights to me. D, I think that would be more like state statutes, so I'm kind of leaning towards C.
And what was C again?
A legal framework of governing.
That sounds interesting. And you think that D, the detailed code, was a bit too detailed to be a constitution?
Yes.
Okay, and what was B again? You thought that was more...
The rights and privileges of citizens.
And that was more of a statement of like a Bill of Rights.
But isn't the Bill of Rights part of our Constitution?
Hey, no fair, Kelly. You're not supposed to be giving hints. Anyway, what do you think? You think you're going to stick with C or you're going to go with one of those other answer choices, Stanley?
I am torn between B and C, but I am leaning towards C.
Okay. Is that going to be your final answer?
Yes.
Kelly?
Woo-hoo! Nicely done, Stanley. Congratulations.
Now, Kelly, you've done something today that I must say is just a little bit cruel. You
tried to trip him up. Come on.
You tried to trip him up. You were suggesting that B was the correct answer, even though you knew it was C.
Well, you know, that it's, you know, I think that sometimes can confuse folk. You know, the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, but is it what, in the question is, what is a constitution? You know, Stanley is right. It is a legal framework of governing.
Very, very good. Well, Stanley, you didn't trip up.
Well, I was tempted.
Okay. But you resisted temptation. So congratulations. You will get a T-shirt emblazoned with your weekly constitutional. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. Our subject today is same-sex marriage. Now, we already heard from an opponent of same-sex marriage, Jim Campbell of the Alliance Defense Fund. Now we're going to hear from another viewpoint. We're going to hear from Mark Strasser, who is the Trustees Professor of Law at Capital University Law School, and he's also the author of a book called On Same-Sex Marriage, Civil Unions, and the Rule of Law, Constitutional Interpretation at the Crossroads. Is same-sex marriage a constitutional right?
Let me talk about it in a couple of ways. One question is how likely it is that the court or members of the court will now recognize it as a right. And another way to look at it is whether it ought to be recognized in light of some of the past kinds of cases we have on marriage or on equal protection. I am more confident that a good understanding of many of the cases would strongly suggest that it should be recognized as a constitutional right. I am not as confident that the court, that a majority on the court would agree with me, so I'm not expecting that the court anytime soon will recognize it as constitutionally protected.
Well, I must simply chuckle at your response, not because there's anything wrong with it, but because it's very much the law professor lawyerly response. But if I may translate, then in layman's terms, it means that you think that it should be or is a constitutional right, but you're not confident that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to agree with you.
That plus it is my understanding, given the past cases and what the court has articulated as being the important interests that are implicated, and some of the ways we decide cases, that makes me think, yes, this too would be recognized, in part because many of the state and individual interests that support recognizing that people, as a general matter, have a right to marry also apply when there are same-sex couples.
Okay, well, let's get into that. What are those previous precedents? What are the other cases and other situations where the court has held that people have a right to marry that you think might also be applicable to gay people?
Okay, well, certainly we have Loving versus Virginia was an important case in which the court struck down a Virginia law that precluded individuals of different races from marrying.
Oh, right, back in 1967.
And the court basically said, offered two bases. One, it said that something so important as marriage should not be precluded from individuals on an irrelevant characteristic, namely the races of the parties, that this is something that is important for individuals, and there was no good reason to prevent the individuals from marrying just because they were of different races. The court also suggested that the right to marry is a fundamental interest. It involves very important matters for all individuals. Does that mean that all individuals want to marry? No, of course not. But for those who want to marry, this is an essential, or at least for many, this is something essential, extremely important. And that's true whether the people want to marry someone of the same sex or someone of a different sex.
Now, Loving versus Virginia used two different constitutional theories, two different parts of the Constitution, to rule that people of different so-called races could marry each other. One of them was the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment.
That's right.
And the other one was a bit more obscure theory we call fundamental rights under the Substantive Due Process Clause. But as you say, then, there are two different theories there. One is that it makes things unequal to say black and white people can't marry each other. The other one is that everybody has a fundamental right to marry whomever he or she pleases. Now, you think that those two concepts apply with equal force to the situation of same-sex marriage?
You know, I don't want to say equal force for a particular reason. And this is more with the equal protection analysis. So historically, The court has examined classifications on the basis of race very, very closely because they strongly suggested animus or sort of invidiousness. There was no good reason, but instead it had to do with bias. Now, the court has not said that classifications on the basis of orientation merit the same kind of analysis, and the court has also not even said that classifications on the basis of sex merit that very, very close scrutiny. So in some sense, I'd say, sure, they're distinguishable. We don't have this tradition of looking very, very closely. Nonetheless, I would suggest we don't have good reasons to prevent individuals of the same sex from marrying. And so in that way, it's analogous. And I can talk about why we don't have good reasons.
Okay, please, but, please do.
Okay, so some of the reasons that we talk about that marriage is important, it's important for society, and it's important for the individuals themselves. And when we're talking about the individuals themselves, we might talk about the interests of the adults who might be marrying. We also might be talking about the interests of children that they might be raising. Now, it turns out, as it's gotten increased attention, many same-sex couples are raising children, and the children are benefited or can be benefited in a number of ways when their parents are allowed to marry. Those ways might include financial. For example, if you might have something like insurance coverage that maybe the children would not be covered unless the parents could marry. And so that itself would be a benefit. There are also non-financial benefits that might be afforded. If there's increased stability, there may well be an increased commitment either between the partners or from partner to child. In the background, we have questions of whether each member of a non-marital couple can adopt, and especially because it is not the case that in all the states, both parties would be able to maintain a legal relationship with the child if those parties are not themselves married. That's all the more reason to allow the parties, should they want to marry, to provide a good home for children and actually to increase the commitment between the parties. And insofar as we're benefiting the parties themselves, society will benefit, both because the adults are doing better, because children are doing better.
Mm-hmm.
We get investment in the relationship, we get all kinds of benefits, and all of these have in fact been discussed by the court. But when the court has talked about them, the court is focused on different sex couples and the children they might be raising. It just turns out that many of those benefits would accrue regardless of the sexes of the parties.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. We've been talking to Professor Mark Strasser of the Capital University Law School. After the break, we'll talk a little bit more with Professor Strasser, and then we'll have a constitutional profile. Stay tuned.
Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before. Don't imagine you're too familiar, and I don't see you anymore. I would not leave you.
It's your weekly constitutional, and our subject is same-sex marriage. We've been talking to Professor Mark Strasser of Capital University Law School. Now let's rejoin our conversation. Okay.
So. Yeah.
Oh, well, no, this is all very interesting. So what it boils down to then is there any good reason that you can think of to treat gay people differently? I mean, and that's the essential measure in lay terms under the Equal Protection Clause. I mean, government, it wants to treat people differently, to allow certain people to marry and other people not to marry. Is there any legitimate reason for government to do that, in your opinion?
I do not believe so. And actually, you know, it's not even so clear that the courts, and this is the state courts, not the federal courts, the state courts have been addressing this issue too. Of course, there are traditionally, they'll say, but that in and of itself doesn't seem to support, to offer a good reason if there are reasons against, namely helping the individuals themselves, the children, the family members, their extended family. There are all kinds of reasons why the state should be promoting marriage.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean that the state is precluded from prohibiting any marriages. The argument, rather, is if the state is going to, it ought to be offering good reasons.
Right. And I, if I'm hearing you correctly, you haven't seen the states offering good reasons. And in fact, even the rationale that's often cited, that, you know, marriage is for the creation of, and protection of children, it tends to be undercut a little bit when you talk about older couples being allowed to marry, or infertile couples being allowed to marry, because, of course, they're not going to produce children either.
They are not. And further, one of the sort of surprising aspects of the procreation argument is basically the claim is something like the following. We believe that it is possible for couples composed of individuals of different sexes to have children, and often that is the case, though, of course, as you point out, not always, but often it is, and that very possibility suffices. But, and here I think is another surprising part, for same-sex couples, not all, but for lots of same-sex couples, not only is it possible that they might have children in the home whom they are raising, but they do. So this is to say the possibility that different sex couples might have children is enough to give them this protected interest, but the fact that same-sex couples are having children doesn't seem to suffice. And this is a kind of surprising argument, even if you're focusing just on children. But of course, there are interests in marriage that are, even if you don't think of children, couples marry, of course, even when they don't plan on having kids, because they have interests in marrying. And those are present whether the couples are composed of individuals of the same sex or of different sexes.
Right, and that actually brings us to the other constitutional basis. We've been talking about equal protection as the as a basis for saying that couples, same-sex couples, should perhaps be allowed to marry. But then there's the corresponding and the corollary, the other basis, the constitutional basis, and that is the idea that couples have a fundamental right, completely apart from being treated equally to others, but it's simply a fundamental right that every adult has to marry whomever he or she wishes. I wonder if you could comment on that strain of constitutional thinking, that basis.
And that would be fine. Now, and I just want to modify it. I don't think it's quite that every adult has the right to marry anyone that he or she wishes, but at least that the state has to be offering good reasons to justify the prohibition. Now, for example, when we think back to Loving, which we'd mentioned before, where the court recognized that the Virginia law violated constitutional guarantees because, as you pointed out before, of this substantive right, the substantive due process right or right to privacy. One thing that's noteworthy in the Loving decision is the court nowhere mentions that its focus is on children. That really is not what the court was doing in its right to marriage analysis, in part because Virginia had been claiming that its statute prohibiting interracial marriage was based on its alleged interest in children. So the court didn't go there. Instead, it was talking about the interests of the adults. And also in Turner versus Safley, we have another case, and this involved prison marriages, where the court did not focus on children, but rather talked about the individual's interest, the individual interest in emotional commitment, in making a public statement. So there are a variety of interests of the adults themselves. Can the state prevent some marriages? Yes, if in fact there are very important interests that would justify it. But those kinds of interests have not been put forward.
Well, let me ask you about one possible line of argument, or one argument that's been made out there. There are many religious conservative people from a number of different religious traditions who say that allowing same-sex marriage would violate their religious beliefs in such a profound manner that it would somehow be a violation of their religious rights guaranteed under the religion clauses of the U.S. Constitution. Is there anything there? Is there a countervailing constitutional right that's implicated by same-sex marriage?
Well, and, you know, there are a couple different issues implicated here. Now, first of all, when we're talking about a right to marry a same-sex partner, it must be understood this is not a claim, for example, that particular religious denominations are going to have to recognize same-sex marriage. So it is not as if recognizing this right would automatically require a religious institution that did not believe this was appropriate suddenly to have to open up the doors to weddings or something like that.
Okay, so just to be clear, if the state of, for example, of Tennessee decided that it wanted to authorize same-sex marriages, that does not mean then it would require, for example, a Catholic priest to then have a gay wedding in his church.
That is correct. And the Constitution would preclude the state. Not that the state would want to do this, but even if it did, the Constitution would protect the religious rights implicated. And so the state could not force a particular religious group to celebrate such unions. Now, you'll note, actually, if you go back to Loving, one of the issues at least suggested there was it was pretty clear that individuals believed that interracial marriage violated God's law.
Yeah, in fact, the trial judge was pretty explicit about that, wasn't he?
That is right. Yeah, and so here, you know, we didn't have the court go in this long exposition, but it's merely to say that if it were really true that a religious belief was enough, that would speak to precluding a lot of religions. Precluding a lot of marriages. For example, not only might it have justified the prohibition on interracial marriage, it would also justify the prohibition on interreligious marriage, because it might well be said that a particular religion did not think it appropriate to allow individuals of another religion to intermarry. And further, depending on the kind of religious views held, it might justify not wanting to allow people out of the faith to marry. Now, it's certainly true the religious institutions themselves will not be forced to celebrate unions even where this is recognized, but it goes much farther to say that other individuals would not be allowed to marry because it violated particular beliefs, and these are sincere beliefs. I'm not questioning that. It's just a very sort of robust contention that because my religious beliefs preclude another relationship, therefore such people should not be allowed to marry at all.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, Mark, and I'm glad you make it that There are lots of prohibitions on marriage. There are lots of different views on when it's appropriate to marry. I'm aware of some churches where they don't think it's appropriate for people to remarry after they've been divorced, or to remarry in other circumstances. And nothing says that those churches have to change their viewpoints simply because society at large allows divorce and remarriage or allows interfaith marriages. So there's the civil concept of marriage, which is what we're talking about, and then there's the religious concept. And even if the Supreme Court said that same-sex marriage was a constitutional guarantee, it would not really implicate anyone's religious beliefs at all. People are free to go on believing whatever they want to believe.
And further, the religious institutions would be free to continue to celebrate those marriages that they thought appropriate, but also to refuse to allow the celebration of those marriages that they did not think appropriate. And you might also even think of intergenerational marriages, if there were a strong belief, a religious belief, that marriage is fundamentally about procreation, then perhaps there would be a belief that individuals who could not procreate or who would not, who positively just didn't want to have children, should not be allowed to marry. Well, if there were such a belief, then of course, religiously, you could be doing that, but that isn't the kind of thing that we would want to translate into civil society, I don't think.
Well, now, those were some fascinating interviews with Jim Campbell of the Alliance Defense Fund and Professor Mark Strasser of Capital University Law School. But now we have a couple of minutes for what we like to call a constitutional profile. And there's a very interesting fellow in who's been very involved in this entire debate over same-sex marriage. And to discuss that very interesting person, I go back to my former student, Joni Burrows. Joni, who are you going to talk about?
I was going to talk to you today about the Reverend Mel White.
The Reverend Mel White. That name rings a bell. Who is Mel White?
Well, Mel White was born in 1940. He graduated in 1962 from Warner Pacific College. That same year, he married his wife, and they had two children together. He worked for a very long time with the evangelical Christian right movement. He was a speechwriter for a lot of the big evangelical figures in the movement, and he was also a ghostwriter for people like Billy Graham, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Jim Baker on their autobiographies.
All of those guys?
All of those guys.
So he was right in the middle of this. He was part of the movement.
Yes, he was very much considered the behind-the-scenes guy on the Christian right movement for a very long time.
Sort of the Peggy Noonan of the Christian right, the go-to speechwriter.
Exactly.
Okay.
And he actually does, he got his doctorate in ministry at Fuller Theological Seminary. So he is a reverend, and he has had, you know, intensive training in religion.
Okay. Well, so, what why are we talking about him?
We're talking about him because despite his activeness in the religious movement, he eventually came out to his wife and admitted to her that he had been attracted to men for his entire life.
And Billy Graham's speechwriter or ghostwriter was gay?
Yes.
Is gay. Oh, good heavens.
Yes.
All right. Well, so he came out, and what happened then?
He first came out to his wife, and they tried to work together to kind of find a cure, if you want to call it that, for his homosexuality. He went through psychotherapy. He used prayer. He even went so far as to seek out an exorcism and also used...
An exorcism.
Yes, an exorcism.
He tried to have demons cast out of himself.
Yes.
Did he get rid of those gay demons?
No, he didn't. And unfortunately, he did try to attempt suicide. And
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
But after that attempt, he and his wife decided to divorce on amicable terms. And she actually wrote the foreword to his book, Stranger at the Gate, which was his first book that he wrote as himself, not as somebody else's ghostwriter, and just kind of chronicles his journey as a man of faith, but also a gay man in America.
Wow. What sort of obviously he and his wife have gotten over their initial shock and difficulty because of this revelation, but what has been the wider reaction in the evangelical or the Christian right community?
Well, obviously, the religious leaders were not very much a fan of his quote-unquote lifestyle, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he really has kind of taken a step back from the religious right, but is still very much involved in the religious community today. He actually is a member of the Metropolitan Community Church, which is a church that very much promotes gay and lesbian rights and very much welcomes them into the church and receives them with open arms, pretty much. And they're kind of a cool church too, because they're one of the few churches that have a female at their senior leadership position, the Reverend Elder Nancy Wilson, and
mm-hmm.
she was just recently elected to lead the church. So that's pretty cool too.
Very interesting. Now, did what sort of reaction did he get from his former associates? I seem to recall you said something about and some sort of problem at Liberty University.
Well, he did. Mel White did found this group called Soul Force, which is his kind of his baby. It's his way of promoting the idea that gays and lesbians, there's nothing wrong with that, and that we're all God's children. children. And through that organization, he's done a number of protests, and he and his partner have been arrested along with a lot of the other participants in Soul Force for numerous protests, including one time when he was arrested for trespassing at Pat Robertson's CBN property, and he actually spent 22 days in a Virginia Beach jail.
Okay, that. So that was not at Liberty, it was at Regent University.
Right.
So he got booted off of the Regent campus and put in the pokey, apparently.
Yes, he spent 22 days in jail, and actually Pat Robertson came and visited him. And based on his Mel White's talk with Pat Robertson came out almost immediately afterwards and completely denounced a lot of the violence that was going on towards gays and lesbians. So he was very much moved by Mel White and what he had to say.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear anybody speak out against violence. And of course, the significance of this, beyond of course the personal significance for Mel White and the significance for gay people and their spouses and their families, the constitutional significance is that it points out a very important thing, and that is that the religious community in the United States is not monolithic, and it's not accurate to say that all religious sentiment is anti-gay.
Right.
There is definitely some far more tolerant religious sentiment, even pro-gay in some sense, or pro-gay rights, I should say.
Very much so.
And I guess Mel White is a living embodiment of that.
Right. He proves that you can be gay and also be a Christian at the same time.
Very interesting. Well, thank you very much, Joni Burrows, for that fascinating constitutional profile of the Reverend Mel White. Well, we're almost out of time, but before we go, Joni, why don't you tell me what are the developments as of June 2011 in that very important case out in California, Perry versus Schwarzenegger?
Well, as your listeners may know, on August 4th, 2010, that's when the district court in the Ninth Circuit released their opinion saying that there was no evidence to support Prop 8. The defendants in that case, the supporters of Prop 8, obviously appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Oral arguments were heard on that case on December 6, 2010, and on January 4, 2011, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit certified a question to the California Supreme Court asking whether or not the folks defending Prop 8 actually have standing to continue to defend Prop 8 on appeal.
Okay, now that's a very important point. Now, it might seem a little obscure to some people, so let me just explain what's happening here. Normally speaking, if someone challenged Prop 8, it would be the governor, through the Attorney General of California, who would defend it. But both Governor Schwarzenegger and his Attorney General at the time, Jerry Brown, declined to defend this case. So there was no one to defend Prop 8. And so the supporters of Prop 8, through their lawyers, one of whom was Jim Campbell, whom we spoke to earlier, came forward and said, we'll step into the shoes of the state of California and defend this case. But there's always been a question as to whether that was appropriate.
Right.
And so the federal court has asked the Supreme Court of California, is that appropriate? Are these the proper people to defend Prop 8? Has the Supreme Court of California answered that question yet?
No. The California Supreme Court is going to hear arguments on in September of 2011. And once they hear those arguments, they're going to have 90 days to issue their own opinion. And then it'll go back to the Court of Appeal, the District Court of Appeals, or the Federal Court of Appeals, for them to go ahead and decide the case.
So we are months and months away from this case even getting to the merits.
Right.
We're arguing about whether the parties are correct.
Right.
Good grief. Well, sometimes the wheels of justice spin slowly, and I guess this is just another one of those circumstances. Thank you very much, Joni Burrows. And thank you very much to our guest today. Thank you again to Jim Campbell of the Alliance Defense Fund. Thank you also to Mark Strasser, the Trustees Professor of Law at the Capital University Law School. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.